Their team broke the seal and opened the big swinging doors at the back of the semi-trailer. Men climbed up into the truck to assist in offloading the critical parts Rafael had been carrying.
"How did it go at the border?"
Fernando asked. Rafael held his head up a little higher.
"Javier and Esteban became martyrs today. God has welcomed them home with rich rewards. Many infidels died. It was a good day."
Fernando nodded and climbed up onto a forklift to start unloading Rafael's semi-trailer truck. The first thing they loaded into the front of the small cargo van was the generators and batteries that would produce the 5 kilovolts needed to charge a high-energy capacitor to fire the detonators. They had already assembled platforms to anchor the most valuable part of the load. Next, they carefully pulled the 2 cases, each holding a pair of half-spheres of plutonium-239, surrounded by tungsten carbide bricks and beryllium reflectors, from the semi-trailer, and placed them on the platforms in the cargo van, and secured them down. Over those cases, they placed the steel shells for the outer casing. They would help protect the cases, should they have any kind of accident. When the time came, the 2 halves of the plutonium spheres would be assembled along with a polonium-beryllium neutron initiator placed in their hollow centers. Those initiators would help kickstart the chain reaction to prompt criticality. The pit would be placed inside a heavy lead tamper, several inches thick. That, in turn, would be surrounded by explosive lenses made of Semtex. The Semtex explosive lenses, fired with the EBW, would create a shockwave designed to collapse the lead tamper inward. The tamper's inertia would spherically compress the plutonium-239 pit to critical mass. Miguel's team had been in place for a while now and had been forming the Semtex into precisely shaped geometric pieces that later would be assembled into a sphere to surround the lead tamper in the inner shell. They had established their operation in a deserted industrial area that had proven to be a perfect source of the nearly 1,000 pounds of lead they would need for each bomb. Their Iranian shell company had bought the entire building, as well as another smaller building and machining workroom with old but workable milling machines. Once finished with the machining at the smaller workspace, Miguel's men would move to the larger building to begin working the lead into the spherical tamper that would surround the plutonium pit. Miguel's team had also machined the brass chimney sleeves that would hold the detonators. Conventional detonators didn't have the precision needed to make all the explosive lenses go off simultaneously. To make those explosions highly symmetrical, the detonators would need to be connected by exploding bridge wire that had already been delivered to Miguel's team by courier. When the proper voltage hit the EBW, the high current would melt and vaporize the wire in microseconds. The resulting shockwave would fire all the detonators in the same instant. While precise yields were very difficult to determine, calculations done by Iran's nuclear engineers, along with the help of North Korean scientists, suggested a little over 100 kilotons. Once Rafael and his team reached Miguel and his men, they could begin the final assembly. The test of Iran's first atomic bomb would not be conducted in some remote desert location. It would be conducted in America. This would be the great Satan's Hiroshima and Nagasaki. 36. This particular Mossad operations facility had always reminded Jack of a mission control center for spacecraft launches. Like the seating in a mini amphitheater, rows of curved counters with workstations descended toward a small stage with a wall of monitors behind it, displaying up-to-the-minute information. Those monitors were alive with everything from maps to scrolling lists of information to video feeds of demonstrations going on at different locations. One of the feeds showed a speech being given at the United Nations. Another was a live feed of an interrogation of a prisoner. Dozens of controllers, managers, and coordinators tended monitors of their own, along with their own sets of switches, buttons, and knobs. Many of them were talking on headsets. These operators tracked and were in communication with agents in the field. When Jack had been in the United States and called in, he talked to Devorah in this very operations center. As Jack made his way across the surprisingly quiet room, he immediately noticed that all the controllers seemed especially tense. Some of them pored over reams of paper readouts in their laps. Others were talking into headsets. The lighting in the room was muted to make it easier to see all the information both at their own screens and on the large monitors against the wall. It gave the place a kind of foreboding atmosphere. Jack spotted Devorah Artsy and stopped at her station. When she saw him, she broke into a sudden smile as she pulled off her headset and then stood to squeeze him in a warm hug. "How are you, Jack?" she asked, holding his shoulders as she looked up at him with a broad smile.
"I'm okay," he said, without much enthusiasm.
Ehud saw Jack stopped at Devorah's station and rushed over to meet him.
"Jack," he said as he extended a hand. "Where have you been? Didn't you get my messages? I've been trying to reach you for weeks. It's not like you to be out of communication."
Jack shook hands with the man as he looked around.
"Sorry, Ehud," he said, returning his attention to the man. "I just didn't want to search for another subject right now."
"It's not your fault that Uziel was murdered."
Jack flashed him a weak smile.
"Nice try, Ehud. But if I wouldn't have found him and convinced him to help us, he would be at home and safe right now. Safe at home, mourning his wife. You gave him a reason to care about living. You let him be part of something bigger than himself. You didn't force him to help us. He wanted to do it."
Jack sighed.
"I suppose."
He didn't want to debate it, so he didn't.
"But I'm thinking I may take a break from our work. I'm a little sick at heart of finding people who can recognize killers only to watch them be murdered."
"Jack," Devorah said. "These are special people. They are hunted by those who want to kill their kind. You save many of them by finding them first. You saved Kate. If not for you, she would have been slaughtered without ever knowing the reason. She never knew about her ability until you found her and helped her understand what she could do. If not for you, she would be dead. Not just her, but others as well." Jack smiled more sincerely.
"True enough. I just wish I could find her. I taught her a little too well how to go off the grid and become a ghost to hide from those killers."
"Anyway," Ehud said, interrupting a conversation about Kate, "that's not why I've been trying to reach you."
Jack folded his arms and devoted his full attention to Ehud.
"Okay. What's up?"
"What's up?"
Ehud looked a little surprised.
"Haven't you been listening to the news?"
"No. I've had my phone off. I'm a bit sick of listening to all the problems in the world. I wanted to be left alone to do some background research on some of the super predators I've been hunting. I've been thinking about taking some time away from all this to go do that for a while."
Devorah frowned with concern. "You don't know about the attacks?" Jack looked between Devorah and Ehud.
"Attacks? What attacks?"
"In America,"
Ehud said, lifting his hands out in exasperation.
"There were also some terrorist attacks in the UK. One stabbing at a nightclub in France, and a truck attack in Brussels. But there were a great many more in the US, and they were much worse."
"Worse?"
Jack's arms unfolded.
"What happened in the US?
Devorah sat down at her station and pulled up video of a massive hotel fire. Ehud gestured to the monitor.
"That's a hotel in Las Vegas. They still don't know the death toll. Right now it's 30 or so, but it's expected to climb over 100. It could even go much higher. It was started by a large incendiary device that probably contained jellied gasoline. It went off on a lower floor, taking out elevators and trapping people on higher floors. The stairs were destroyed by explosive devices so that people couldn't escape as the fire climbed up inside the building.
Devorah switched to another scene. This is the airport in Tampa. The surveillance video showed people walking along, then debris and smoke exploding out, leaving bodies littering the terminal. She pulled up another video showing rescue personnel with gas masks carrying people out of a subway station in New York City. Another video showed the aftermath of a car bomb in a big United States city, but it could have been a scene from Baghdad.
Who claimed credit for all the attacks? Jack asked, as Devorah kept pulling up different videos,
different scenes of destruction and victims.
Each attack was claimed by a different group, Ehud said.
Astonished, Jack glanced down at the monitor.
Has that ever happened before? A series of attacks all carried out at once with different groups claiming credit?
Ehud clasped his hands behind his back.
No, not like this. To tell you the truth, we don't know what's going on, but it's obviously very troubling.
Here's one of the worst, Devorah said as she pulled up what looked like a war zone in Syria. Shells of burned-out trucks littered the scene. This is Oeste Mesa, the big commercial border crossing between Mexico and California.
This attack was accompanied by a cyber attack that took down the entire U.S. network for their border stations, Ehud said. Besides this attack here, there was also a mass shooting, several people with machine guns, at a crossing into America from Canada. The terrorists killed 5 agents and almost 24 civilians before they were shot dead. This attack at the Oeste Mesa was much worse.
There are several terrorist groups that have been working on that kind of cyber warfare, Jack said. Sounds like they chose this time to strike.
There were also cyber attacks on air traffic control, as well as power plants and other infrastructure.
Ehud glanced at Devorah before looking back at Jack.
U.S. intelligence services leaked to the press that the cyber attacks were Russian.
The Russians?
Jack put one hand on a hip as he swept his hair back with the other. He held the hand against the back of his head as he paced a few feet away and then returned.
That doesn't make any sense at all. The Russians doing something like that, especially in coordination with terrorist groups, would cause the Americans to jump to a war footing.
Ehud arched an eyebrow.
They did.
Jack cast about for some answer that made sense.
You have to know that it's possible to make a cyber attack look like it was done by anyone. Russia, China, even Israel. All it takes is a team inside Russia to set up servers using Russian credit cards to pay for hosting services, and then use a VPN to remote into those servers from access machines inside the country. That would make it look to all the world like the hack had been done by Russia. The evidence would seem irrefutable, unless you really understand how it can be done.
Ehud waited until Jack had paced back.
The problem is, U.S. Intel leaked information to the press, saying that the Russians carried out the cyber attack. People are used to things like this on a smaller scale from Russia or China. Ransomware attacks have crippled large companies, hospitals, and government agencies for some time now. So this being done by the Russians makes perfect sense to many in the American intel community. Of course, the news media and thus the public are absolutely convinced it was the Russians. So they're up in arms. They're demanding action. Some are even demanding a strike at Russia.
But it doesn't make sense. It's most likely not true.
Perception is reality, Devorah said. Jack paced off again, thinking, looking at the wall of monitors. Many of the scenes of destruction and panic were the attacks in America. Something was bothering him.
"The Mexican bomber you captured in Jerusalem," he said when he realized what was nagging at him. "That has to be connected to these attacks."
He pointed at Dvorah's monitor showing the carnage at the Oeste Mesa border crossing from Mexico into the United States.
"That's too much of a coincidence. Your Mexican bomber isn't really Mexican, is he?"
"He says he's from Santiago de Querétaro, Mexico. He doesn't speak any language except Spanish. We're sure of that much." "We questioned him about Santiago de Querétaro and growing up in Mexico. Once we got into the details, he knew a lot of the basic information, but he wasn't convincing. When pressed, he came up with the name of a street where he says he grew up. He described a pretty standard Mexican slum, but we don't believe the street exists. There were other things as well that led us to believe he's lying."
"What do you think he's covering up?"
Ehud pinched his lower lip as he glanced around the room and lowered his voice.
"We found something on one of his boots." "Okay," Jack said. "What did you find?"
"A speck of plutonium-239 stuck in the lugs of the sole."
Jack stared at the man for a long moment.
"He certainly didn't pick that up walking around in Santiago de Querétaro. Nor did he get his suicide vest there, either. The materials that were used in it are common throughout the Middle East, but not Mexico."
"Any suspicions where he picked up plutonium?" Jack asked. Ehud shrugged unhappily.
"Pakistan? Iran? A terrorist group bringing material out of Russia?
Hard to tell."
"Were you able to get anything useful out of him?"
"We told him that we found nuclear material in the sole of his boot. We pressed him about where he could have picked it up. We pressed him hard. He seemed confused about everything, including how to answer our questions. He seemed lost and disoriented. He started to cry. He cried for hours and hours as we continued to ask him questions in Spanish. It seemed like being captured was something that had never crossed his mind before, and now that he was away from the people he knew, he didn't know what to do or how to answer. He knew, though, that he wasn't supposed to cooperate. We put him back in a cell to let him think about it and get a little sleep before we questioned him again. Captives expect torture. Letting them get some sleep instead often helps soften them up so they will begin answering a few questions. A few answers eventually lead to a few more, and so it goes. Sometime while the guards were changing, he managed to kill himself."
"He killed himself?"
Jack was stunned.
"How could that happen? You know quite well that these terrorists are suicide risks. You take precautions to prevent it. Wasn't he in a straitjacket or something like that to prevent him from killing himself?"
"Yes, of course."
Ehud sighed.
"You won't believe it. He apparently stood up off the floor, likely on the toilet, and did a back flip to come down on his head and break his neck. He was fine 1 minute, the next minute his neck was broken and he was dead. But he did unwittingly leave us one clue before he died."
"What's that?"
Jack asked.
"His arms and hands were restrained, so he rubbed his nose until it was bleeding and wrote, 'Allahu Akbar,' on the wall."
"That doesn't sound very Mexican," Jack said.
"We're running DNA analysis to see if we can come up with his country of origin," Dvorah told him. 37. Jack leaned in next to Dvorah to look more closely at her monitor. It showed a map of America with little circled numbers and corresponding information points down the right side.
"You know,
It feels to me like these attacks might be a smokescreen, he said. I suspect that there is some overriding objective, and all of this is meant to obscure that objective. A smokescreen, Ehud considered for a moment. Many of those groups are competitors for money and resources. Terror attacks gain them status. Status gets them money, resources, and recruits. They are not going to cooperate with each other. Jack lifted an eyebrow. They would if they didn't know they were merely a diversion, and if the whole thing was promoted to them as a competition of sorts, a chance to show off what they are capable of, a big game day of sorts. Put to them by who? Ehud asked. Jack shrugged. Take your pick. But only a state sponsor would have the weight and authority to be able to bring all these different Islamic terror groups together for a chit-chat and convince them to attack at the same time. What if these groups thought they were taking part in an audition of sorts to see who should receive that state's financial support? Ehud hooked a thumb behind his belt. You're connecting a lot of dots that we don't see. At least, not yet. Maybe. But it worked to get Jose to try to blow himself up. He thought he was doing something great. I'm sure they didn't tell him the truth, that they were only using him as a diversion to accomplish something they wanted more, getting rid of Uziel. After all, because of Uziel, we took Wahib captive. I think someone might be doing the same kind of thing here, creating a diversion. I'm listening, Ehud said. Jack gestured at the monitor. These attacks were carried out by different groups, right? It seems like the coordination and lethality of Islamic terror groups have reached an entirely new level.
It certainly has the U.S. up in arms, Devorah said.
But could it be a diversion, like Jose was?
All right, Ehud said. I like the way you always think outside the box, but a diversion for what?
Jack thought a moment. Can you pull up any photos from the American cameras at the border crossings where the attacks happened?
Why the border crossings? Devorah asked. What about the rest of the attacks? Do you want them as well?
For now, I just want to see the border crossing attacks.
Jack gave them both a meaningful look.
Jose was simple-minded. I think he became more useful to them as a diversion, but when he walked away to do their bidding, he walked away with a bit of plutonium stuck in his shoe. Where would they want to go with plutonium?
Ehud and Devorah shared a look.
Jack gestured to the screen. Let me see the photos you have from the border attacks.
There's surveillance photos and video from the Canadian-U.S. border attack, Devorah said. The terrorists' timing was off. They started before the cyber attack brought down all the systems. That means the cameras were still in operation during the attack, so we have some good visuals.
First, Devorah clicked through dozens of facial recognition photos of people in cars waiting in line. She stopped at a young couple in a pickup. The woman had a black scarf on her head.
This is the couple that carried out the attack. The facial recognition software didn't hit on them, so they weren't on a watch list. Nothing about them triggered alarms.
A lot of homegrown terrorists don't show up on any watch list, Ehud said. They only become known to authorities after they kill people. That's why the people you find, like Uziel, are so useful.
Next, Devorah showed Jack a video overlooking the lanes of traffic with the man and woman's truck waiting in line a few vehicles back from one of the booths. Suddenly, the man and woman both sprang out of the truck with AK-47s and started spraying bullets at the border agents. The attacking couple looked to have no intention of trying to get away. They didn't fire from cover. They were there to the death. Jack could see several agents go down and smoke from gunfire off-camera being returned. They both screamed, Allahu Akbar, as they killed surprised people.
Some of the people in cars leaped out and tried to run, only to be cut down. Some people tried to hide in their cars, only to have the couple spray their vehicle with a deadly hail of bullets, killing them where they hid. They fired their weapons in sequence, alternately switching full magazines for empties while the other fired. That indicated practice and planning. It also kept up constant fire, with lethal rounds going everywhere to make it more difficult to return fire. They stood in the open on either side of the truck, shooting at officers in the booths as well as through the windows of a building off to the side. Armor-piercing rounds went right through the bulletproof glass, vehicles, and vests. A well-placed shot to the head abruptly took out the man. The woman was wounded in the leg and left arm, but kept firing her weapon until she was killed by a bullet through her throat. When she went down, a bomb in the truck went off and took out the camera. They weren't refugees or illegal aliens who had slipped into Canada to carry out an attack, Devorah said. They were both identified as children of Syrian parents, both born and radicalized in Canada. They left a lot of online rants. Chatter from American authorities indicates they believed that the woman convinced the man to devote himself to jihad, along with her. What we're looking for wouldn't be homegrown terror, Jack said. Show me what you have from the Oesta Mesa border crossing with Mexico. Devorah pulled up files, then clicked on one of them. It was a video from a surveillance camera that showed a normal day at the border checkpoint. Vendors could be seen in the distance, walking between trucks, hawking their wares.
As you can see, everything looks routine, Ehud pointed out to Jack.
Devorah nodded.
All the video is from before the cyber attack shut everything down. Everything went dead sometime before the attack began, so there isn't any video showing where the attack came from or how it unfolded.
She showed him a series of photos of the aftermath. It looked like a war zone in Mosul. Pieces of truck frames, heavy parts like axles and engines lay scattered. The checkpoint facility was in ruins, and bodies lay strewn everywhere. Rebar stuck up from broken concrete barriers. All the skeletal remains of the trucks were blackened from the intense fires.
It was a horrific attack,
Ehud said, in a tone of voice that sounded as if it were in reverence for all the dead. Jack had seen carnage plenty of times. It didn't tell him anything.
Do you have any of the facial recognition photos, like the ones at the Canadian border?
Sure. But those cameras went down a while before the attack, just like all the rest of their equipment, so they don't show anyone the Americans suspect of being involved. They believe the attack came from people waiting in trucks farther back, before they could be captured on the cameras.
Devorah started opening files of one face after another of men sitting in their trucks, waiting in line. Nothing Jack saw looked out of the ordinary. It struck him that many of the faces he was seeing of people waiting in line would die that day. After a few minutes, though, something caught his eye.
Stop! He pointed. Right there.
Devorah halted on a photo of a driver sitting in his truck. It was a photo similar to all the others taken by cameras at every lane at the border crossing, the same way every truck then had to go through X-ray machines and neutron scanners. The photo showed a driver who looked Mexican. He was yawning so that you could see that he had a gold molar. Jack tapped the screen.
There. Blow that up.
Off to the side of the truck that was the subject of the photo, just barely in frame, was a face in the background. It was a man on the passenger side of the truck behind. He was sticking his head out the window to try to see what was going on ahead of the truck he was in. Devorah clicked a key several times, enlarging and centering the face on her screen.
Shit.
Ehud leaned in.
What is it?
Jack pointed at the blocky face of a man with short black hair and beard.
Him. I recognize the trim of his beard above his jawline. It's not quite cut square. I didn't see his face at the time, but I'm almost positive that's the guy who killed Uziel a few weeks back.
I wish we had a name, Devorah said with a sigh.
We do, Jack told her.
Kasiel Icon Korekan.
Devorah looked back over her shoulder.
You know who he is?
Jack straightened as he ran his fingers back through his hair.
Kasiel Icon Korekan is one of the super predators I've been trying to find for years. He's a proficient killer. Like other men I track, he's a serial killer. Killers like that are wolves. They don't like being seen by sheepdogs. So he also hunts down and kills people like Uziel, people who have the ability to recognize killers for who they are. That rare ability to recognize killers is genetic and usually runs in families. So once Kasiel recognizes one of these people for their ability, he will often slaughter their entire family. He has murdered people in several family lines that I'm aware of. I'm sure there must be others.
Well, it appears he has taken up a new interest, Devorah said. He must be working with this terrorist group that wanted Uziel dead, and who also attacked the Oesta Mesa border crossing.
A man named Kasiel, a terrorist?
Ehud made a face.
Kasiel is an old Hebrew name. It seems unlikely that Islamic terrorists would trust a man with a Hebrew name.
Old Hebrew is its primary origin, Jack said. But the name has other meanings, especially in certain countries.
Like where? Devorah asked.
Like Azerbaijan, where he was born. Azerbaijan is a mix of cultures, but they are a people for whom names hold great meaning. Children are not named because the parents like the sound of a name. Names are given because they are meant to impart a certain nature upon a person. Bravery, health, strength, tenderness, beauty. Babies are expected to grow into their name.
So, what do you think is the meaning of his name, if it is not a Hebrew name? Devorah asked.
A few old texts sometimes describe Kasiel as the Angel of Tears. He is sometimes regarded as the ruler of the moon.
Well, Ehud said, he certainly has brought tears to many people.
Devorah didn't look convinced.
If it's typically an old Hebrew name, what makes you think the obscure, alternate meaning, ruler of the moon, applies in this case?
Because of his middle name, Icon, Jack said. Icon means king of the moon. I think his parents used Icon for his middle name to indicate the intended meaning of Kasiel.
Okay, so let's say we believe all that, Devorah said. What do you think this business about ruler of the moon means? What did his parents mean him to grow into?
I wish I knew.
Jack pulled over an empty chair.
Here. Let me use your console so I can get into my files and see what I have on him.
Jack had a number of super predators he was trying to locate. He gathered intelligence on them whenever possible and added it to their file. Eliminating any of these killers would save countless lives, but by their very nature they were difficult to track, and each case was time-consuming. So he did his best to instead find people with the kind of vision those predators hunted. Sometimes he could help them stay alive. Kate had been like that. Sometimes, though, even when he did his best, he couldn't help them. Some people didn't want to face the truth of what would be coming for them.
Wait, Devorah said as she started typing. Let me send the name to some of the other stations first. The more people looking for information, the more we'll be able to dig up.
Ehud snapped his fingers to get the attention of nearby operators.
Devorah is sending you a name. Find out everything you can about this man. We believe he was involved in the terror attacks in America.
People at nearby monitors nodded as they looked at the name before beginning searches.
He was born in Azerbaijan, a man to the right said.
They already knew that, but Jack let the operators search as they would rather than try to direct them.
Interpol suspects him in murders in several countries, another operator said. He has been questioned on several occasions by authorities in those countries, but there was never enough evidence to charge him in connection with any of the murders.
Again, Jack was aware of that. He had a few photos of the man from those interviews, and it was clear it was the same man he was staring at on the monitor. After Dvorah finished, he typed in his credentials and opened his cloud account.
He is believed to have killed several members of the Al-Salim family in Jordan, a woman two stations over to the left said, and, get this, 11 members of the Maruf family in Egypt. The Italian authorities believe he murdered several members of the Constantine family, another operator said.
Jack paused in his search through files. He looked up. Constantine. That name rings a bell for some reason. He went back to his own search as other agents called out a few names of victims associated with Cassiel.
Here it is,
Jack murmured to himself as he sat back, staring at the screen. There was an older couple in New York State who were shot, execution style. 22 caliber bullet in the backs of their heads. My cross-reference tools had pulled up the name of that murdered couple because they had the same last name as the family in Italy that was thought to have been murdered by Cassiel. Last I checked, the police in New York had no clues or leads. The murders are unsolved. That's why you don't have a link to them for Cassiel. But Jack had a photo in his physical files of Cassiel that the Italian authorities had taken when they questioned him before letting him go. It was a real photo printed on photo paper from an actual negative. Those were like gold for Jack's particular calling.
Another one of those troubling coincidences? Dvorah asked. Cassiel murdered Constantine family members in Italy and a couple by the same name was murdered in New York State?
It's more than a coincidence, Jack said. It's a connection.
Ehud rubbed his chin as he frowned off in thought.
But why would this serial killer, Cassiel, be right there as a terrorist attack is about to take place?
Beats me. Find out what you can about the Constantine couple in New York State, Jack said to Dvorah as he rolled back out of the way to give her room to get at her monitor again.
Cassiel is a hunter, Jack said. A wolf. He likes to go after families to eliminate anyone with the ability to recognize killers. See if there are any more Constantine family members of the murdered couple in New York.
38.
I've got a pair of hits, Dvorah said. Sally Constantine is the daughter of the murdered couple. Then there's an Angela Constantine, granddaughter of the murdered couple and daughter of Sally. Birth dates for both. No death certificates. Both must still be alive. Angela would have been young at the time her grandparents were murdered.
That's certainly a close family connection, Ehud said. I wonder why Cassiel didn't also kill the mother and daughter when he was there and killed the older couple.
Jack leaned back in his chair.
It may be a tactic he uses to confuse anyone looking for him. He doesn't follow any patterns that I can figure out. He sometimes randomly returns to hit other family members, so you never know where or when he will abruptly reappear. A lot of killers work in an area. He works all over the world. Sometimes the time span is so long you never know if he will ever return to kill relatives. So you waste a lot of resources waiting to see if he will be back. In several cases, he hasn't returned. That may be his method of operation, or it may not be a tactic at all. He's a brutal serial killer, so it could be that he simply gets distracted by a woman he has abducted. He has a thing for abducting young women and keeping them in homemade dungeons where he can torture them for prolonged periods of time.
Easy enough to pull off that kind of thing in a lot of the third world countries where he likes to prey.
Look at this, the man at the next station to the left said. He gestured to the monitors on the big wall in front of the mall. This was a very strange killing in Milford Falls, where the older couple was murdered and those two Constantine women live.
Everyone looked up at a big monitor to the right side of the wall. While other nearby monitors flickered with videos of everything from speeches to riots, a static police photo showed a man dangling from a bridge by a rope tied around one ankle. He had no shirt. His torso was covered with knife wounds and streaked with blood. It looked like there was something carved into the flesh of his back.
"Can you enlarge the words, please?" Jack asked.
"Sure," the man said as he clicked keys and the image got bigger until they could all read what it said. "I killed Carrie Stratton." Dvorah twirled a lock of her curly black hair around a finger as she stared at the big monitor. "That's pretty damn weird."
"It sure is," Jack agreed. "But I don't see how it has anything to do with either of the Constantine women, and certainly not Cassiel. He doesn't torture and kill men. Any idea who Carrie Stratton is?"
"She was a nurse in Milford Falls," the man who had put up the image said. "She was abducted and murdered. The writing on the dead guy's back led authorities to her body. DNA analysis of the semen and material under her fingernails confirmed that he was indeed the man who had killed her."
"Damn strange involuntary confession," Dvorah said. Jack had to agree.
"What do you have on the Constantine women?"
"The mother is a longtime drug addict," Dvorah said as she scanned a series of police reports on her monitor. "Methamphetamine is her drug of choice. She has a long history of arrests. They all look to be drug-related, nothing violent. Most of the time, the charges were dropped for a variety of reasons. She does have a string of drug convictions, though. Looks like she always got off with time served, probation or drug rehab. She appears to be a user, not a dealer. From the sequence of arrests, it's obvious that rehab never worked. A good many people have been arrested in raids at her residence on other charges. Drunk and disorderly, possession with intent to sell, possession of firearms by a felon, and some fights, a few with serious injuries."
"What about the daughter?" Jack asked, as he leaned back in his chair, twirling a pen around his fingers as he listened.
"Angela," Dvorah murmured as she went through several pages. "Let's see what we've got." She finally stopped on a page. "Well, this is interesting." Jack looked up.
"What is it?"
"She was recently hospitalized."
"For what?"
Dvorah leaned in as she read the report on her screen.
"She was raped by four Hispanic undocumented aliens. They beat her nearly to death, then hanged her by her neck with a rope and left her to strangle to death. She managed to escape and get to a hospital. Looks like she was in bad shape. Cuts and abrasions, some damage to her spleen, things like that."
"How did she escape the hanging?" Ehud asked.
"Doesn't say. She identified the men and they were arrested, but released."
"Released? Why?" Jack asked.
"It just says that the charges were dropped by the assistant district attorney," Dvorah told him.
"Doesn't say why." Jack tapped his pen on the counter.
"I don't like the sound of that. Charges are often dropped for a variety of reasons," Ehud said from behind Jack. "Maybe, but something about it doesn't sound right. She was seriously injured. She identified the men. They were arrested. Seems pretty cut and dried. How do they not at least get tried? Do you have an address on her?"
Sally has an address in a trailer park, but Angela's address is listed as a box at something called Mike's Mail Service.
That's kind of odd. Jack sat up and rested an elbow on the counter beside Devorah.
Let me see what her social media looks like. We should be able to get good information from that. Let's see her Facebook page first.
Devorah typed, looked at the screen, typed some more, clicked on a few places, looked some more.
Nothing. Devorah shook her head. She doesn't have a Facebook page.
Jack was now fully focused.
What about other social media?
Devorah did brief searches, reporting after each one.
No Instagram account, no Twitter account, no Google Plus, no LinkedIn.
She typed and clicked some more.
She doesn't have a YouTube account, nothing on Pinterest, no Tumblr. She doesn't use Reddit, no Snapchat, nothing on Swarm or Flickr or Kik, no WhatsApp account, nothing on Quora, Vine, or Periscope. She doesn't visit Dig.
Maybe she's using something more obscure, Jack said. Some smaller site.
Devorah looked over at him.
I'm using our proprietary scanning tools. If I can't find her by using these tools, then there's nothing to find.
Maybe she uses another name online, Ehud suggested.
Devorah shook her head.
Our tools would have found a link to an alias or fake name. There is none. There are no photos of her online, dressed or nude. I can't even find so much as an online review posted by her.
She has zero footprint online. The hair at the back of Jack's neck was standing on end. This was a marker of an unusual type of person. The kind of person he tried very hard to find. If her relatives were killed by Cassiel, that strongly suggested that she had that kind of vision that got her relatives, both in Milford Falls and those back in Italy, killed. The same kind of vision that got Uziel killed. People who had that kind of vision tended not to be social creatures.
Jack gestured at the screen. Let me see your driver's license.
Devorah pulled it up. Jack looked back at a young woman staring out at him.
Angela, Angela, Angela,
he murmured as he stared at the stunningly attractive young woman.
What do you see with those eyes of yours?
Devorah moved the photo to one of the big monitors on the wall ahead and then started looking for more information.
Tax records show that she's employed as a bartender at a bar called Barry's Place. She makes really good tips, and reports them, believe it or not. She also has a courier business, Angela's Messenger Service. It does well, too.
Devorah paused, clicked a few places, and then started scanning down through a page of listings. She swiped the cursor back and forth over one in particular to highlight it.
Remember that woman who was murdered in Milford Falls? Carrie Stratton? Well, the hospital where she worked uses Angela's messenger service.
It sounds like a small city, so that may not mean anything,
Ehud said.
And maybe the young lady doesn't have a social profile because she works so much.
Jack was seeing too many connections for it all to mean nothing.
I think she's one of those with the vision to recognize killers, he said, half to himself.
Ehud frowned.
How do you know that?
It's what I do, Ehud. I'm very good at it.
He looked up.
I need to get a plane ticket to the U.S. I'm starting to get the feeling that time is of the essence.
Ehud seemed perplexed.
What makes you think all this?
Connections are part of what I do, part of why you pay me. There are starting to be too many suspicious connections. I need to be able to look at this Angela Constantine in person to tell for sure if she is able to see killers for who they are. I will recognize it in her eyes if she has the ability.
but I also need to go there for bigger reasons.
Like what? Devora asked.
We captured that supposedly Mexican suicide bomber because he failed to complete his mission. He only spoke Spanish, and at some point he came in contact with plutonium. Had he completed his mission, we wouldn't know either of those two things that don't make any sense. Had he detonated that suicide vest, we would have assumed he was just another terrorist. He was being used as a diversion so that an assassin, Casiel, could kill Uziel. The thing that disturbs me the most about this man pretending to be Mexican is that he had plutonium-239 stuck in his boot. That links Casiel to nuclear material. Now, Casiel just happens to be right there at the scene of a massive terrorist attack at Oeste Mesa. He is on his way into the U.S. That can't be a coincidence.
What does the Mexican connection have to do with anything? Ehud asked.
Muslims in America might be noticed. They stand out. Mexicans, though, are largely invisible in America.
That's true.
I think there might be something bigger behind the terrorist attack in the U.S., and it involves plutonium-239, nuclear material that can be used for a bomb. Jack stood. I presume you're going to brief American intelligence agencies on what we've learned? An attempted suicide bomber posing as a Mexican who had plutonium-239 on his shoes and the rest of it? Ehud pinched his bottom lip as he thought about it.
I will talk to people higher up, but no, I don't think we would wish to do that.
Jack was surprised.
Why not?
Because the American intelligence agencies would leak all of this to the press like juicy gossip. That would send people to ground and make it all the more difficult to find out what's really going on. Leaks are an unfortunate fact of life these days, Jack admitted with a sigh.
It's been getting worse. American intelligence agencies have gradually become more dedicated to a political agenda than a security agenda. They increasingly view spying on American citizens and politicians, including members of Congress and the Senate, as their mandate and a legitimate objective.
Legitimate objective? Where did they get that idea?
Political operatives have increasingly swelled the ranks of the agencies. Their attitudes and agendas have gradually infected the intel community. Leaking top-secret information is a tool and a weapon they use with increasing frequency. It helps the deep state grow in power all the time. Just look at this latest leak about the Russians being responsible for the cyber attack. Congress is calling for heavy sanctions, and some even want a declaration of war because of that leak. And the information is almost certainly wrong. That leak was crafted to further a political agenda, increase the budgets of the agencies, and thus increase their power. It has nothing to do with protecting America against terrorism. It is becoming more and more dangerous for us to share certain information with agencies that increasingly view Israel as an enemy. These days, many in the U.S. intel community would not be upset if Israel were to be wiped off the map. They actually think that would solve the problem of terrorism.
Do you really believe the situation with American intelligence is getting that bad? Ehud arched an eyebrow.
Why are you no longer working with them to find people who can recognize killers, the way you now do for us?
Because it is politically incorrect, that's why, Ehud said, answering his own question.
They care more about being politically correct than protecting lives.
In that case, Jack finally said, I think I'd better get to the U.S. in a hurry and see if I can fit some of these pieces together. Jack pointed up at the big monitor showing Angela Constantine's face, and she is one of those pieces of the puzzle. I don't know where she fits in, but I think she does.
Ehud frowned, suspiciously.
I thought you wanted to take a break from this never-ending war.
Jack gave him a look.
The war seems to want me back.
Ehud nodded.
We will send you on a diplomatic jet.
Jack clapped the man on the shoulder.
Thanks, Ehud. I better go pack a bag. I'll stay in touch.
He gestured down at Dvora.
Stay by your phone.
Always. And Jack, please, come back in one piece this time. 39. As she turned down the long hill out of Milford Falls, Angela spotted the police cars in the distance at Barry's place. Seeing police cars at the bar was not entirely out of the ordinary. Guys would frequently get belligerent, typically over a woman, and cause trouble. It could be anything. A word, a look, or the wrong gesture. Sometimes women helped instigate it. Some women got off on men being jealous over them. With some booze, men's inhibitions tended to evaporate, and they would decide to settle scores. If it looked like it was going to come to blows, and especially if it did, Barry would push such fights outside into the parking lot. If he thought it was serious enough, he would call the police. Angela wondered what sort of jealous nonsense it was this time. As she got closer, Angela spotted an ambulance backed up to the door at the rear of the building. Because the ambulance was at the back door, she became more alarmed, worrying that maybe Barry had been hurt in a robbery. As hard as he worked all the time, it could even be that he had a heart attack or something. There was a small crowd standing around, in addition to at least a half dozen police. Some of the police, their pads and pens out, were questioning people in the crowd. A second ring of people stood farther back, out of the way of the police. They appeared to be curious onlookers. It was now obvious to her that whatever it was serious. Angela rolled quietly into the parking lot and parked away from the crowd and the police. She recognized some of the gathered people as locals who frequented the bar. As she sat in her truck watching the police talking to several women who worked in the bar, the ambulance pulled away, its emergency lights strobing the scene. It turned on its siren as it pulled out of the parking lot and headed up the hill toward the hospital. As the ambulance went up the hill, a white crime scene van pulled into the parking lot and parked by the rear of the building. Several people with equipment emerged and went inside. Angela needed to find out what was going on, so she carefully pulled out her gun, then the suppressor, and hid them under the floor mat where it went under the seat. She hated having to do it, but she also pulled her knife out of the sheath in her boot and slid that under the passenger floor mat. All she needed was to have an overzealous cop, like that bitch from the hospital, Officer Denton, spot the weapons and arrest her. Getting caught carrying a concealed weapon was trouble enough, but having a suppressor in her possession would be much bigger trouble. That prick John Babington would love to prosecute her for that. Angela spotted Tiffany, one of the girls who served drinks, all by herself, some distance back from the crowd, watching the police. She was in high heels with ankle straps and a skirt so short it barely covered the bottoms of her ass cheeks. Her heels and knees were pressed together as she hugged her bare midriff. Most of her hair was piled up on top, with some strands hanging down strategically, along with lots of stray wisps going everywhere. Tiffany always said that it gave her that just-fucked look that guys liked, which made her better tips. When Angela quietly approached her, Tiffany turned to see who it was. It wasn't cold out, but she was shivering as she cried. Tears dragged long streaks of black mascara down her face. Tiffany, what the hell is going on?
Tiffany swallowed. It's Barry. I don't know if he's going to make it.
Angela put a comforting hand on Tiffany's back. What happened? Did he have a heart attack or something? She didn't want to ask if he'd been shot in a robbery for fear of making it be true. Tiffany took a tissue when Angela offered it. She pressed it under her eyes.
No. Someone beat the shit out of him.
Is that what the police said?
No. I'm the one who found him when I came into work just a little while ago.
Do the police know who did it?